I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another edition of Health Watch, our monthly series with Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. This year, as bad as the city homicide rate is, the number of deaths from opioid overdoses is even worse. Congress has passed the 21st Century Cures Act, directing $1 billion to target the national epidemic of opioid addiction. How will that affect local efforts to help people caught in the grips of drug dependency? Dr. Wen is the co-chair of a local group assembled to devise a comprehensive strategy and a national leader in addressing this national dilemma. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her weekly review. Dot is the new show at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore. And we'll take a moment to remember those we lost in 2016 who left an unmistakable legacy on the cultural life of our community. Midday starts right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. It's time for another edition today of Midday Health Watch, our monthly visit with Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of the City of Baltimore. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions and comments for Dr. Wen. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Wen, happy holidays. It's good to see you.
Happy holidays. Great to be here.
So, Lena, I do want you to know we've already gotten an email. Susan in Baltimore says, so proud of our Dr. Wen. Keep up the good work. So we'll start with a high five here today, you know, and then we'll devolve from there.
I wish all of our emails looked like this, right. But no, I feel very honored and privileged to serve Baltimore.
Well, and of course, you are going to be now serving under a new mayor. How would you characterize your relationship with Catherine Pugh?
I greatly admire Mayor Pugh and her extraordinary commitment to public service, having served as a member of the city council, a leader in the state senate, and now as our mayor. There is this palpable excitement throughout the city about her taking the reins as mayor. I mean, I've been extremely grateful to serve under Mayor Rawlings Blake, who is an extraordinary mayor, and I'm now very glad to be working with Mayor Pugh, who shows such an innate understanding of what it means to be healthy, that health is not just about physical health. It also has to be about emotional health, and that what contributes to health goes beyond what happens in a hospital acute care setting. It's also about where we work, where we live, where we play. That health ties into every aspect of our city, into education, into jobs, into public safety. And so I'm glad to be working with her to advance the well-being of our residents.
So you guys you feel like you're on the same wavelength when it comes to public health and the way to approach it.
Absolutely. And in looking forward with our Healthy Baltimore 2020 blueprint, we aim to engage every sector of our city in improving health. Not only our traditional partners with community groups and neighborhood associations and hospitals, but also businesses, faith leaders, neighborhood association leaders. Everybody should be involved in this goal because it does affect everyone. And that convening authority, that ability to bring people together is something that I so greatly admire Mayor Pugh for, and I'm thrilled to be working with her.
Of course, the mayor, the governor, the state legislature, the city council, you will all be functioning in the age of Trump. We now have a new president, or will have one in a month or so. What's your expectation? What's your understanding? I mean, we talked last time about Obamacare and the importance of people signing up for health insurance if they hadn't done it, or renewing it, or tweaking it if they want to. In fact, more people have done this in this sign-up period, which ended on Monday, I guess, than ever before. 6.4 million people signing up for a plan that Senator McConnell has pledged to repeal on day one of the Trump administration. What's your take on moving forward?
The ACA has brought healthcare coverage to millions of Americans and tens of thousands of Baltimoreans. Healthcare access and health insurance is critical to being healthy. There's a lot more than just healthcare access and health insurance, but that is one critical component. There's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen with the ACA and with health and healthcare in this country. On our part, we continue to make the case that a commitment to fiscal responsibility is a commitment to public health, that if we are concerned about protecting national security, we also have to be prepared for public health disasters. We all have to make sure that our core infrastructure is intact so that we can protect against bioterrorism, so that we can stop infectious diseases, and so that overall this is about the well-being of our country. And so I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I do know that we in Baltimore have never taken a backseat to public health. We've always been innovators. We've always set the course for the state and for the country, and we'll continue to do so.
Secretary Burwell, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, has said that if they were to repeal Obamacare on day one, as the Republicans are suggesting they're going to do, and then put some sort of hold on it, or put some sort of, you know, a two-year moratorium on any actual changes, that would cause incredible disruption and stuff. Do you feel that way as well? I mean, if it is in fact repealed and replaced with something, of course, obviously it remains to be seen what the Republican Party wants to replace it with. But how does that affect the city of Baltimore? How does that affect funding for particular programs? Does it affect funding for particular programs if there is this sort of two-year hiatus or some period of time wherein they figure out what they want to replace it with?
I worry about the impact on the everyday person, on our residents in the city. I was working in a clinic yesterday, and so many of our patients are coming to us saying that they don't know what the future is going to hold for them. I mean, we're talking here about policies in an abstract sense, but they have direct impact on the person who is walking through our doors, our neighbors, our colleagues. And that uncertainty is what I'm very concerned about. I'm also worried about the fact that for us in the Baltimore City Health Department, we receive over 80% of our funding from state and federal grants. Our federal grants provide for care for our patients living with HIV. They provide reproductive health services. They provide care for our pregnant moms and for babies, and so much more. That funding is uncertain. And so that's why a few weeks ago, I joined with 10 of my counterparts across the country who are all leaders in major cities, including Chicago, New York City, and LA. We represent in total 31 million Americans. We wrote an open letter to President-elect Trump and to his team about the health needs that we see for our 31 million residents. Healthcare access through the ACA and health insurance is a part of it, but we also want to make sure that there's a commitment to fighting the opioid epidemic, to stabilizing the public health infrastructure, and in general to focus upstream on these early interventions that make a big difference to improve health and reduce mortality.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is our guest. It's the Midday Health Watch. 410-662-8780 is our telephone number. Midday at WIPR.org is the way to get us through email. And at Midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Let's talk a little bit about an issue you have been very much a national leader on, and that is the issue of opioid dependency, addiction, and the incredible number of deaths that are caused by overdoses with opioids and heroin and that kind of thing. It does appear that the city of Baltimore is once again on track to have more deaths from opioid abuse than homicides.
Yes.
As horrible as the homicide number is, you know, it's going to be 300 plus. We're going to do more than, we'll have more people lose their lives through opioid overdoses. You just had a meeting Tuesday night, this work group on drug treatment access and neighborhood relations. Tell us what that group has been focusing on.
I have been co-chairing this work group along with Don Fry, the president and CEO of the Greater Baltimore Committee, and also Bill McCarthy, the CEO of Catholic Charities. This work group is on drug treatment access and neighborhood relations. And the purpose is, first of all, recognizing that we are nowhere near the appropriate capacity when it comes to treatment for addiction. Addiction is a disease. It has to be treated as the disease that it is, not as a choice or a moral failing. That's what science tells us. And yet, we know based on the recent Surgeon General report that 1 in 10 people who have a substance use disorder is going to get the treatment that they need. And yet 1 in 7 Americans, and this statistic I find shocking, 1 in 7 Americans will face a substance use disorder themselves at some point in their lifetime. So addiction does not discriminate. It's not random people who get it. It's our family, our friends, the people who we know. And so this work group looks to improve access while at the same time recognizing that in Baltimore, just like across the country, unfortunately, there are areas around our clinics that there are people who prey on those in need. There are individuals who try to sell drugs to those who are getting treatment, therefore creating problems for that neighborhood when it comes to crime and loitering and nuisances and other issues.
Yeah, that's why this is a work group on drug treatment and neighborhood relations. So there are a lot of neighborhoods, I guess, who have to be talked into the idea that a treatment center in their neighborhood is a good thing.
Long term, the World Health Organization, Surgeon General, and many others have done studies showing that for $1 invested in treatment, that results in $12 saved for society, and that providing treatment reduces crime, reduces violence, reduces these nuisance issues that the communities are concerned about. Short term, though, there are legitimate concerns that we're hearing from our businesses, from our neighborhood leaders, and it's important for us to engage in this comprehensive planning process to understand more about how can we balance these issues. There are also areas in our city that really lack treatment access. And so how do we ensure that we have have treatment at the time that people need it? 1 in 10 people getting access to treatment is just morally unacceptable. It's unscientific. It's bad for our economy and just doesn't make sense.
I guess fairly recent data shows that more than 33,000 people died from opioid overdoses in 2015 nationwide. As we mentioned, it's, in the 300s here in Baltimore.
Almost 400. Yeah. 393 people died last year from drug and alcohol overdose just in Baltimore City alone.
Just in the city.
Just in the city.
How much does the medical community bear responsibility for this? Are there physicians that are prescribing these opioids in a way that has contributed to this vast increase? It's like up 72% or something in the last 3 or 4 years. It's a newish problem. And is that because folks are getting hooked on these things when they're post-operative or they've got chronic pain that's being treated with opioids?
When we look at the statistics, we find that there are over 240 million prescriptions for opioids written every year, which is enough for every adult American to receive their own bottle of opioids. There's no way that Americans can just be in that much pain that we need that many opioids. So we absolutely have a problem of overprescribing. The root of that problem, though, is not as easy as we might think. It may be tempting to blame a few bad doctors who are running pill mills. And yes, they do exist and should be prosecuted and held accountable for their actions. But the problem is much more insidious. It has to do with drug companies marketing opioids and talking about taking away pain as the most important thing, even though when you fall and you bruise your knee, having pain is okay. It has to do with medical practice and culture. In medical school, I learned about taking away pain. I never learned about the addictive impact of opioids. And I routinely prescribed opioids to people, to my patients, who I look back and they did not need opioids after all. But I did not know that at the time.
Is it kind of a new thing in medical training? I remember a friend of mine just a couple of years ago, who's a doctor at Johns Hopkins, said, it's a relatively new phenomenon that physicians were responsible for your pain. I mean, if you had if your body, endured a trauma because of surgery, it was just expected that you were gonna hurt for a little while.
There has been extensive documentation on how the pharma industry has changed the practice of medicine so that pain is documented as a vital sign. So that as soon as someone walks in and says, I need to see a doctor, a question that's asked is, what is your pain scale?
You do the 1 to 10 thing now.
That's right.
We never used to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, with the implication that pain is bad and that the goal is taking away pain, when actually the goal should be finding out the diagnosis and treating the patient and making them better. Again, if you fall down, if you sprain your ankle, maybe having pain is okay. But giving patients that option to put up their ankle and put ice on it is okay. But this is a cultural shift that's happened not just with doctors, but also with patients. There is an expectation by patients that their pain should just be gone, that there should be a pill for every pain.
Yeah. You go to the doctor to get rid of your pain instead of necessarily getting rid of the cause of the pain, right? I mean, or maybe that's the ancillary thing now.
And 80% of patients who use heroin first started by using prescription opioids.
Right.
And we have to remember that that is that cycle that exists, and that it's our duty to ask, what is it that we are doing ourselves to be complicit in this?
Yeah.
That doctors are doing something, but patients are involved too.
Right. The early discussion about marijuana in the 70s, and the hippie era, the 60s and 70s, was that marijuana was a gateway drug to heroin. Now the gateway drug to heroin is oxycodone, right? I mean, it's a complicated thing. We are going to come back after a little break and continue this discussion with Dr. Lena Nguyen. She is Baltimore City's health commissioner and is my guest this hour on the edition of Midday Health Watch. 410-662-8780 is how you can call us. Midday at WIPR.org is how you can email us. And at Midday Tom Hall is how you can tweet us. We'll be right back with Dr. Lena Nguyen. Stick around. Welcome back. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow at this time, it's a special hour of holiday programming from NPR. Tomorrow, it's Tinsel Tales, which includes beloved stories from the NPR archive, including the iconic Santa Land Diaries by David Sedaris. That's coming up tomorrow during the midday hour. And coming up later today in our broadcast, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join me for a review of Dot at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore. And if you're just joining us, it's the Midday Health Watch with my guest, Dr. Lena Nguyen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go to the phone. Sharon in Baltimore, welcome to Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Nguyen. It's great to talk to you this afternoon.
Well, thanks for your call.
I was in Lower Remington, right around the corner from your studio, and my concern vis-a-vis the treatment centers is that we seem to have a lot of centers cited along Maryland Avenue and along Lower Remington Corridor. And my concern, and the concern that I'd like your working group to work with, is how do you make decisions about siting treatment centers and neighborhoods that feel like we're already impacted by a number of treatment centers and a lot of the problems that you discussed earlier on in this segment about narcotics dealing, vandalism, loitering. There are a lot of concerns about people in Lower Remington, and a lot of us feel that treatment is a really vital service that the city can provide, but we feel like we're being overwhelmed by the number of centers in the community.
All right, well, thank you for your call, Sharon. Of course, it's a delicate balancing act, isn't it? You've got to have it. Centers need to be accessible to people who need them, but you don't want to overload neighborhoods and create other ancillary problems.
And Sharon, this is what you cited is the issue, one of the issues that makes this problem so complex, because we are still bound by federal law. And and there are laws saying that we cannot discriminate against a protected group of people. So people with substance use disorders would be a protected group. We don't say, well, let's make sure that we don't have dialysis clinics too close to each other. Right? I mean, I know that there are different issues associated with it, but working with the law, can we provide regulatory mechanisms and also incentives so that we do have treatment centers in areas that currently really lack them? How can we ensure that there is good quality of care? Because there are evidence-based treatments that we know work. There are 25 million people across America who are in recovery from substance use disorders. We know what works, the combination of medications combined with psychosocial treatment, combined with other wraparound services. We need to make sure that these quality services are available, and we also have to work on the issues of stigma and misconception as well.
And your work group certainly has gotten a lot of feedback from community members like Sharon and folks in Remington and folks in other neighborhoods throughout the city about, you know, the impact on their communities if these centers are set up there.
That's right. And we've had three open meetings with time for public testimony thus far, and have heard from a large variety of stakeholders, including from community members, leaders of neighborhood associations, as well as many people in recovery themselves, which has been in quite an incredible experience to hear from people who had the courage to come and attend our meeting, talk about their personal experience, and share what steps are helpful to them in moving forward.
Before we take another call or two, I want to ask you about the 21st Century Cures Act, which is, I think, $1.2 billion or $1 billion, bill that the Congress just passed. This is years in the making. They've been thinking about this for a long time. It's any time Congress gets together and agrees on something is kind of an interesting and rare occasion. It will increase funding for research. It will address problems or weaknesses in the mental health system, and it will also alter the regulatory system for medical devices and how some drugs are approved. What will the impact in Baltimore be, and what's your take on whether this is good legislation? Because there were folks, particularly on the left, Senator Warren from Massachusetts was a leader in opposing this bill, thinking it was too much of a giveaway to Big Pharma.
The specific section of the 21st Century Cures Act that we supported, which is the authorization of over $1 billion over the next 2 years to address the opioid epidemic, that's desperately needed funding. It's very frustrating when we know that the need is there, when we know what works, and yet we don't have the funding to do so. It's very frustrating when I see patients in the ER who are coming to us requesting treatment that I know they need, and medically it's unequivocal that they need, but I tell them they have to wait weeks or months to be able to attain it. That's not ethical, and we should not be. We should be doing better as a city and as a society. So that $1 billion will certainly be helpful in getting there. As I understand the 21st Century Cures Act, the state of Maryland has to apply for it, and then that will be distributed to local areas. So we're hopeful that the state will, and also that that funding will then be distributed to areas of greatest need, in particular to areas like ours that are hardest hit by the opioid epidemic. There should be a formula that weighs poverty per capita as well as need, and it's those of us on the front lines who are battling the opioid epidemic who know what to do with the funding, where it's most needed, and where it will be the most impactful on the ground.
And is it a decent trade-off then if there are, in fact, things that were, accommodations made for the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to regulating drugs, when it comes to getting new medical devices on the market? These seem to be the things that Senator Warren was particularly concerned about.
It is always a trade-off for consumer protection versus speed of innovation. And the 21st Century Cures Act, the main part of it, is not about opioids, but is about speeding up innovation and allowing for life-saving treatments to be available to people as quickly as possible. That always has to be balanced with the consumer protection as well. So from our standpoint, again, we very much support the funding for the opioid for the opioid epidemic, understanding, though, that a lot more needs to be done, and that funding is not currently being targeted to areas of greatest need. And we want to make sure that those of us in cities, those of us that have long faced the opioid epidemic and continue to, are able to access those funds directly.
I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Lena Wen's my guest. It's the Midday Health Watch. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our telephone number here, 410-662-8780. Dan in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Wen.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And, Doctor, I appreciate the chance to talk with you. I've always been so inspired every time you talk. So Baltimore's lucky to have you. So here's my sort of question. You've used a couple of really interesting terms. You've used the term ethics. You've used the term or the phrase moral imperative. And, I mean, I know these things are complicated, and I'm just a high school English teacher. I'm not an economist. But I was wondering, without putting you too much on the spot, if you could comment on the possibility that a single-payer health system in the United States might really be, at the end of the day, the only way to meet that moral imperative. You know, if we have the right to life, it would seem that we would just by extension have the right to health care. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more on that. And again, thank you for all your good work.
Well, thanks for your call, Dan. Dr. Wendt?
Difficult questions, Dan, but I first want to say thank you for your kind words and also thank you for your service. My mother was a longtime teacher, and I know how hard your work is every day as well. You know, single payer, along with so many different models for increasing access, they're going in the right direction because it's so important for us to ensure that people have access to healthcare. I absolutely agree that healthcare is a basic human right. It is part of our right to life. It's part of the ethics and morals and basic standards that all of us should hold true. But I want to go beyond our understanding of health as just healthcare. Currently, 97% of cost in health goes towards what happens in a hospital. I'm trained in acute medical care.
97%.
97%.
3% of our healthcare dollars are going to what happens outside of a hospital.
Outside of a hospital.
That's wild.
And yet, only 10% of what determines the quality and length of our life depends on what happens in the hospital. That's why I'm in public health. It was actually an incredibly humbling and difficult realization for me, having gone through so much medical training in as acute care as you can imagine in the ER, to say, wow, I certainly want to deliver great care to a patient who comes to me, but ultimately what determines somebody's life isn't just about the care they receive or access to that care. It's also about the fact that if somebody lives in a food desert without access to healthy foods, they're going to have a higher rate of diabetes and heart problems. It's about safety. If kids don't feel safe going outside to play, if there is huge trauma that's occurring every day, emotional, physical trauma, then that child is going to have difficulty paying attention in school and will have many issues later on in life too. That is our understanding of health that we have not put enough emphasis on. So healthcare reform is a part of it, but investing in public health is a much bigger portion that nobody has put together a policy proposal to really help us to address it.
And again, President-elect Trump has been very unspecific about how he would replace or revise or improve Obamacare. Representative Tom Price, a congressman from Georgia, has been nominated as the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. He certainly has been an advocate for getting rid of the ACA or so-called Obamacare. Is there a way that you know of to continue insuring the people, the 20-plus million people who are now insured who weren't insured before the ACA, allowing pre-existing conditions to exist before you are given insurance, offering insurance to children of people who've just graduated from college until they're 26 years old? Is there a way of doing that without having some sort of public option in the package? Or do we expect that the Trump administration will come up with some new way?
I have no idea what President-elect Trump and Representative Price and others will propose. I am very concerned about our safety net. We provide care here in Baltimore City. We run two clinics. We provide on-the-ground care to those patients who otherwise would fall through the cracks. And I want to ensure that that does not happen. I also want to ensure that we provide all of our ongoing community-based services, including trauma, emotional care services, including home visiting for our pregnant moms, including lead abatement. All of that also goes into keeping our communities healthy. And it's that investment in public health that I urge for President-elect Trump and for all of his team to continue to invest in, and actually to invest in much greater quantities. If they're concerned about return on investment, this is the best bang for their buck. That we know that home visiting for pregnant moms saves many dozens of dollars. That lead abatement can save something like $200 for every $1 invested. It's that commitment to public health and upstream interventions that
we need. It's an economic argument as well as a moral argument, isn't it? Yeah, Allison in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Wendt. As I understand it, you are a nurse and you are well versed in the notion of patients who have pain. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I worked on a surgical floor in a hospital as a bedside nurse, And I think that it's very important when we're using the pain scale, because we use it so often, that 0 to 10 rate your pain, you know, to be upfront and realistic with patients before you give pain medication. You know, you've just had a major surgery. We're doing the best we can to lower your pain, but we're not, we might not be able to get it to a 0. And I think that it's very important for patients to know that, especially because so much about hospitals is patient satisfaction. And they're always asking, you know, when patients fill out surveys, you know, was your pain controlled? You know, controlled might not be a 0. You know, it could be a 2 or a 3. And I think that it's important to be very upfront with patients before we give opioids.
Yeah.
You know, what's realistic for them at this time?
Well, Allison, thank you for your call. It's an excellent point. And it's difficult because, you know, as a physician, there are patients who need opioids. There are even people who need them chronically to get through chronic pain. It's like everything. There's no cut and dry answer, is there?
Absolutely. And the last thing that we want to do is to take away effective pain management from patients who need it. Patients with chronic pain because of cancer need opioids. If you just had surgery or you were just in a terrible car accident, you need opioids. I mean, I don't want to deny patients of this too. But we also know that there are now new guidelines that have come out from the CDC and others recommending, for example, that doctors start low and go slow. Start with the lowest dose possible, going slowly to increase. And following these guidelines is one way for doctors to change that culture. I think that Allison made a very good point, though, about patient expectation, that the goal of medical care should not be to get to pain-free, because there's one issue with that. Getting to pain-free also comes with a significant cost. Getting to pain-free means possibility of addiction, possibility of overdose that we have to consider. And it's important for not only doctors to change their practice, but also patients to ask the question, if you're given opioids, ask, do I need this? What are the side effects? What are the alternatives? What happens if I don't take it? I was in a minor car accident a few months back, and even though I had said to my doctor at the time, I don't want opioids, she suggested it. It's a good idea to push back and to ask the questions, because we're all in this together.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, Dr. Wen. There are a bunch of stuff we didn't get to. You issued the first cold blue alert last week. It's warm today, but it's going to get cold again. So especially for homeless folks and, you know, elderly folks, we got to keep an eye on each other and help folks. But thank you very much. Have a great holiday. Thanks for coming in. We appreciate your doing this every month, and we look forward to doing it again in the new year.
A happy holidays to you. Thank you.
Dr. Lena Wen is the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City, and she joins us about once a month for the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. It is midday. We're glad you're with us today. There's lots more coming up. Stick around. As the year comes to a close, I'd like to take a moment to remember some of the people we lost in 2016 who were important to the local cultural community. Each of them made an important contribution to our civic and cultural life, and I was blessed to know all of them. Roy Hofberger, who died in August, was a lawyer and developer by trade, but an arts lover at heart. He was the co-founder of the American Visionary Arts Museum and a generous donor to the Maryland Institute College of Art. Roy was an inquisitive and eager guy who was also one of the founders of what is now the Institute for Islamic, Jewish, and Christian Studies. Carl Schottler was a reporter with the Baltimore Sun for nearly 50 years. He wasn't an artist per se, but when he passed away in February, we lost an incredibly imaginative and inventive writer. His reporting was distinguished by his acute attention to that ever-illuminating detail, and in his feature writing, he painted vivid portraits of an amazing cast of characters. His ear was as fine-tuned as any musician I've ever known, and his eye for the subtle nuances that made a story compelling was unfailing. Gustav Meyer died in May. He headed the conducting program at the Peabody Institute for many years, influencing generations of young conductors who have gone on to shape the profiles of orchestras around the globe. I taught with Gustav as part of a team that he led in a conducting workshop in the Midwest in the 1990s. The art of conducting an orchestra is an elusive and ambiguous affair, and teaching people how to do it can be a very tall order. Gustav Meyer was a towering giant in the field, imparting wisdom and practical advice with gentility and compassion. Margaret Armstrong lived a long and influential life until she passed away at the age of 100 in July. She helped start the Baltimore School for the Arts, and as one of the few women of color involved in the fine arts scene in Baltimore, she was an inspiration to an untold number of young men and women who were exposed to the arts because of her tenacious advocacy. She served on the boards of the Peabody Institute, Center Stage, and the BSO, and among other accomplishments, she made the arts accessible for countless students. I had the great pleasure of working many times with Gordon Miller, a fine clarinetist with the Baltimore Symphony. His tenure with the BSO, which spanned 50 years, coincided with the orchestra's being established as a band to be reckoned with on the national stage. Gordy died in April, and in June, the unexpected death of J. Riley Lewis was a shock to all of us who are in the business of performing choral music. Riley was one of the most talented and gifted players and conductors I've ever heard. He knew what questions to ask of every score he encountered, and he knew how to parse out the answers with unparalleled grace and dignity. And just last month, Jody Albright passed away, leaving a legacy that includes Artscape, which organizers say is the largest free arts festival in the United States. Jody was one of the very first people in the arts community I met when I moved here in 1982, and I learned early on that she was a force to be reckoned with, tenaciously loyal to her boss, William Donald Schaefer, and passionate about making art accessible and plentiful for the people of Baltimore and throughout the state. And just before Thanksgiving, the designer and artist Bill Steinmetz died. He was a 1950 graduate of MICA and a lifelong animating force of that institution as a faculty member and alumnus. He was also part of an amazing team with his wife, the artist Betty Cook, to whom he was married for 61 years. As an artist, an entrepreneur, and a husband, he was an inspiration. Finally, I want to remember our friend and colleague here at WIPR, Deborah Davis. Deborah was the volunteer coordinator here, a great lover of musical theater, and a committed and dear soul whose loss we all still feel acutely. Deborah left us just a few days before Christmas last year. For all the challenges we face in our city, we are well to remember that ours is a town that produces some extraordinary and gifted people. May they rest in peace, and may we continue the legacies that they worked so graciously to establish. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more after a break. Stay with us.